gay politics, and amongst Britons. The Prime Minister is facing the biggest challenge to his premiership, as the Partygate scandal has snowballed into a political nightmare for him. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether the Prime Minister has any magic tricks up his sleeve to save his position, and whether his party can actually survive this blow, while the Labour Party's popularity has increased as a result. All to get the latest on this first, I'm going to cross on over to London and talk to our correspondent, Amina Taylor. Amina Taylor, what are we looking at here? I'm looking at front page headlines that does not bode well for the Prime Minister. I'm not too sure which one to ask you about as we're looking at all these different really harsh rhetoric coming from these headlines. You tell us what's standing out right now for Boris Johnson and then for the people there in the UK, how they feel about him.
Well, Calvin, we're clearly in the containment section of this operation from the Conservative Party, because it was clear that the deny, 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 and then lie stage was proving to be ineffective. Once photos had been released of the latest party that was taking place during the May 2020 lockdown, this is after we had already had news of the one in December, and then to just add misery on top of insult, on top of disbelief, this party that took place on the eve of Prince Philip's funeral. So with all of this in mind, I think what the Tories are trying to do here is to rally the troops, to go with the position that the Sue Gray inquiry, which is of course the civil servant who is in charge essentially of marking the government's homework here on this one, let's wait to see what she has to say and then we make a move. But if Keir Starmer is correct here, it is very difficult to see how the Prime Minister can say he did not break protocol. And if you break protocol and then you're found to have lied about it, it's very difficult to see how you can stay in your position. I think the only thing that is saving Boris Johnson from having to walk the political plank now is the fact that nobody with any real credibility wants the job as the head of the Tory party at the moment. Rishi Sunak is the man they're touting. He wouldn't want to touch this dirty basket right now. He'd want to wash his hands until the next election, then swoop in. And Labour, they know this as well, Calvin.
Okay, and before I let you go, just very quickly, if you can, this Operation Save Big Dog, which points to government, is that accurate? Is it true or is it just rumors?
It is ludicrous, but I think the idea here is that Boris Johnson is a useful tool for them at the moment. There are still parts where he is liked, but they recognize that it would be electoral suicide for them to get rid of him now, especially with Labour ahead in the polls. So keep him in until we can get a guy and we can distance ourselves from this scandal.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Amina Taylor there, correspondent from London. Thank you for the latest on this. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. We have John White. He's a writer and political analyst joining us from Edinburgh. Also joining us, Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from Belfast. Very well. Welcome to both of you. John White, let me first start with you. When I asked our correspondent about the latest, she went through the events, which may be, in a sense, overlooked by people who are not so familiar, because we're looking at an explosive set of events that happened one after the other regarding these numerous parties and the way that the government reacted to it, which then, if you take a line to the side of that, is filled with lies, is filled with silence. Perhaps you can tell us how that does not bode well for the people who are in power. Or maybe their days are numbered at this point.
Well, just like the US under Trump, under Johnson, Britain is in a post-truth scenario when it comes to its politics. Boris Johnson is a proven liar. He's a rogue. He's a man for whom integrity is a foreign land. And he seems quite astonishingly impervious to the extent of the anger of the British public over these revelations, which are coming fast and furious by the week of further parties that were taking place in and around down the street during lockdown. We're here now, there were regular Friday night wine nights among his staffers and people who work there and work with him closely in his office. So it is quite astonishing the extent, not only to which he seems impervious to the consequences of these actions during strict lockdown, when people up and down the UK were denied the right to be with loved ones on their deathbeds, or be with loved ones for months and months on end because of the regulations and the rules that were passed by his government, and he was standing at the rostrum articulating the new regulations as they came in. People couldn't mix, they couldn't see family members, etc., etc. But the Tory party seems to be intent on circling the wagons. Operation Big Dog says it itself. If Al Capone did politics, he would be on the side of Boris Johnson. He doesn't care about public opinion. He thinks he can tough it out. He's a creature of entitlement and privilege. And you wait to see how this story is going to run, because what he has done is he's managed to unite the UK media from left to right in anger and splenetic rage at the extent to which his government and people working for his government were flouting lockdown rules throughout 2020 and 2021. Sure.
Well, we're going to get into the way that Boris Johnson has conducted himself when it comes to politics. Some say that's his asset, but in this case, we're not sure about that. But Frau Hughes, I have to ask you this about how you have these parties, one after the other. You bring your Blues Party, which really then tick people off. I don't want to beat the events to a pulp here. But when it came to that party that was held the night before the funeral of Prince Philip, well, that also struck a nerve with many people there in Britain, especially when you have the picture of the Queen by herself to sit alone due to the coronavirus restrictions. Did that push this whole thing over the edge with that happening? And how badly or severely did that affect public opinion against Johnson?
Well, I think firstly we'll have to maybe acknowledge the fact that there appears to be a campaign to undermine Boris Johnson's premiership. The fact that these leaks are coming thick and fast, one after the other, it appears orchestrated to put pressure and mounting pressure onto Boris Johnson and his cabinet with ongoing further allegations of these parties. I suppose when it comes to Prince Philip, a lot of the British people are monarchists. I mean, a lot of the tabloid media and a lot of people really from kind of when they're born into the British United Kingdom system are brought up to revere with adulation the royal family. So the fact that they were partying the night before the funeral of Prince Philip does indicate a kind of abject negation of responsibility by those in charge. I mean, normally that funeral would have been huge. The military display that would be attendant to the funeral, all the monarchy there in their regalia and their splendor, seeing off Prince Philip. I think it just proves that there is a genuine disconnect between those who run the country, those who see themselves as entitled, and the elite, the people who have been to the various public schools and the public school upbringing that they've had, these multi-millionaires who claim to be in touch with the common people. I think the disregard shown by Boris Johnson and all those who attended maybe proves two things. One thing is, if it wasn't for the leak, we wouldn't know anything about this, and it would be just a continuation of Boris in power.
Who do you think is responsible for the leaks coming out? I mean, we know the first one. I mean, you're saying that there are successive leaks coming out at this pace that's somewhat not ordinary. But the way the government handled it is obviously also not professionally handled. So that's another aspect of this. But let's move on, and I'm sorry to jump in, because I'd like to move on to how there is now a call from within Johnson's party. John White, sixth Conservative MP, calling for the Prime Minister to quit. We have estimated, based on our sources, 20 may have submitted letters to, I guess, what's called the 1922 Committee, well short of the 54 needed, however. And you talked about Operation Save Big Dog. Is that Boris Johnson's way of trying to get out of this?
Well, we're waiting for the conclusions of Sue Gray, the civil servant who's been tasked with investigating the leaks, the parties, etc., which her conclusions are said to will be published at the end of next week. A lot of Tory MPs are following the line of let's wait for the conclusions to her inquiry while they're not supporting Johnson, but just following protocol. But I'm quite surprised there's only 20 letters gone into the 1922 committee thus far, given the extent of the breaches of lockdown. These MPs will be under huge pressure from their constituents. There are local elections coming up in May. This will be a very telling measure of the extent of public opinion regards to Johnson. The latest opinion polls has Labour 14 points ahead. I still think Boris Johnson carries some favour amongst, especially Red Wall, the North, the new working class base vis-a-vis Brexit. He's seen as more relatable, certainly, than Keir Starmer. Mm-hmm. He likes a drink, he likes a laugh. He's a guy who's prone to scandal, he's got a sense of humour. And that plays well with a lot of people in the country that you feel disconnected from the usual machine politicians such as Keir Starmer. My surprise is that Labour is not further ahead than 14 points, given the extent of these breaches of lockdown, especially as you just touched upon with Farah Hughes regarding the party that was held the night before the Queen attended her husband's funeral almost on her own and obeying lockdown rules. So we're yet to see what's going to happen next week. Sue Gray's conclusions, her report will be key in determining the fate of Boris Johnson. He's going to tough it out. Don't forget that Sue Gray is a Johnson appointee, as is Cressida Dick, the head of the Met Police. Sure. And there's a bit of harsh light shone on her for her inaction so far, willing to investigate previous breaches that have come to light with regards to Johnson and his administration.
Okay. We don't want this, and I'm trying not to make this a Boris Johnson bashing 25-minute block here, but we need to talk about his behavior, Farah Hughes, and I'm going to use the words of a Shoreham MP that I'm sure you're familiar with, Tim Loughton, who has said, the reason for my conclusion in calling for him to stand down is the way that this is handled, and he described it as, quote, obfuscation, prevarication, and evasion to have been the order of the day. Do you agree?
Yes, it's a very good description, and it's very apt, and it's very to the point. First, he denied the allegations. In fact, I think he denied them twice before eventually coming to the fore with the latest information put out into the public domain. He's admitted that he was there. What we're witnessing is Boris Johnson's, it's partly, I think, his personality. He's a bit of a bluffer and a blagger, and somebody will just, like, you know, manipulate and the truth in order to sell himself to both the public and the party. I feel that he's been caught out telling fibs. He's been caught out with his finger in the cookie jar, or perhaps the drinks cabinet in this particular instance. But I think he has told or been economical with the truth in the way he's handled this. So there's a bit of buffoonery there. There's a bit of he's admitted that he's made mistakes, but I don't think it's enough to make him go, because I don't think there's enough will within the Conservative Party to throw him under the bus. Mm-hmm. I do think there's an opportunity, if they can see this through, he'll be there until at least May, when they have the local elections. Sure. And see how he finishes after that.
Okay, well, on that, John White, what has Boris Johnson done? I mean, really, if you think about it, he's the one that perhaps gained his notoriety, in a sense, from Brexit, the deadlock that gripped the UK for so many years, if not the whole world, in a sense. So, what, aside from that, can you tell us?
Well, nothing really. He's gained a lot of credit from Brexit. He's completely mishandled COVID in the UK. 150,000 COVID dead tells its own story. He was too slow to lock down, and when he did lock down, over 2 months after China locked down in January of 2020, he didn't lock down hard enough. He has known to have said, let the bodies pile high, when he was faced with the prospect of having to implement another lockdown. And so, you know, it's surprising to me that he hasn't been forced out of office up to now. The PPE scandals, the High Court in London just recently adjudged that his VIP lane, so-called, giving PPE contracts to Tory donors and so on the pretext of COVID, was illegal. So this is an administration, a government that's mired in scandal, illegality, lies, obfuscation, as you mentioned, and just being economical with the truth. There seems to be no lie that he won't tell, his ministers won't tell, in order to bolster their position. So the corruption is deep, and it's unending. So, you know, he is a rogue prime minister, probably in a long line of such, and it's remarkable to me, as I say, that he's not being forced out of office. You know, I just think this reflects a debased political culture in the UK surrounding Brexit.
Sure. Well, on the line of what you said earlier, Farah Hughes, I'm going to go with two viewer comments here. One, so our politicians lied to us. What a surprise. The real news here is that government officials never have taken the COVID threat seriously. The big question is, why should we? And the next viewer comment, I think it's shocking that Johnson may force subordinates to resign and not himself. The boss carries the responsibility. Boris Johnson is not the ideal PM, but if he resigns, I see no credible candidates to replace him. Should we look at Boris Johnson, the man, and separate him from the party, or are they both in this thing together?
Well, first of all, he's leading the party, and secondly, I mean, there was an invitation to perhaps, was it 100 people, to bring your own and have the party in the Downing Street gardens. And only 30 people turned up. That's telling in itself. That, you know, would imply that 70 people who were invited said to themselves, no, I don't think this maybe is a very good idea. Don't think it's maybe very appropriate under the circumstances with what else is happening with COVID regulations in the country. As I've said, Johnson's leading the party, so he has ultimate responsibility for whatever he does as an individual and also as the leader of the party. But he's got a huge majority. There aren't any elections, meaningful elections outside of the council elections until 2024. He's not going to resign. I mean, there's no way someone with that personality who's been able to get himself to the top of British politics is just going to fall on the sword and he won't go unless he's pushed. And I can't see there being a groundswell of people within the Conservative Party looking rid of Boris Johnson at the moment. And I completely agree with John. I mean, we are just seeing the tip of the corruption iceberg that is British politics. And it's not just British politics. It's all the neoliberal governments across Europe and in America. They're up to their necks in graft, and they're paid for by corporations, and they treat the rest of us, especially the voters, with disdain. They only care about us once every 4 years when we go into the polling booth and put our X against someone's name. And normally sure. It isn't a name, normally it's a party. And with the two-party system we have, both moving further and further to the right, working class people in Britain will suffer for decades to come, regardless of whether or not Boris Johnson's in power this time next year.
Well, you know, when you take a look at what's happening in the world right now, John White, I mean, we're looking at Europe, in particular NATO and the U.S. and the way that they're confronting Russia. We're looking at our part of the world where we get sanctioned every other day, practically, and other world events that shape the world in one shape or another in a major way. That we're looking at the UK and parties where you have to bring your own alcohol. So when you have being the UK trait right now and how it's made headlines, perhaps what I'm looking at here was a quote that was made by a particular MP that says, what we're seeing right now is the culture at 10 Downing Street that is necessary for it to change. What is this culture of 10 Downing Street that requires a change in it, if you agree with that?
Well, it's like the dying days of Rome. We're seeing these parties in Downing Street with people, procuring suitcases full of wine, cavorting in the Downing Street gardens, flouting lockdown rules and regulations at the same time as the morgue were filled up with COVID dead. NHF nurses and clinicians were at breaking point, suffering PTSD, dealing with the consequences of COVID at its height of the pandemic in the UK. It's really redolent of the dying days of Rome. And Fra touched on something very important when he mentioned the word neoliberalism. This is a product of late capitalism. This is a demise of the West on a broader level. And these politicians like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are a product of those dying days. They are the corruption that a corrupt political system produced. And I see this as a very serious inflection point in global politics. The UK coming out of Brexit, that was a last gasp, a death rattle of British imperialism, thinking that resorting to nationalism, Union Jack flag waving, can deal with the problems wrought by neoliberalism in a time of crisis. The wrong lessons have been learned from the financial and economic crash of 2008, mm-hmm. and neoliberalism is a corpse, and it's a putrefying corpse that needs to be buried. Boris Johnson is not the man to bury that corpse, neither is Keir Starmer. So we're looking at the demise of the UK as a state, and I look forward to the day that it breaks up, because it's on the way of breaking up. It has no answers to the challenges of the 21st century, and Boris Johnson is a product of the same apparatus as Keir Starmer is. Nothing good can come of either of those two men in power for the UK to remain a unified state.
Sure. Well, I was going to talk about Keir Starmer, but I don't know after what John White said there, I should get into that. But I have to, because in regards to ratings, where you have obviously Boris Johnson's ratings to plummeted, and we're looking at Labour actually to pretty much on the back of this gained 41% of the vote share based on one particular poll. I don't know if you're a fan of polls there, Frahis. This one by Opinium, putting Labour on 41% of the vote share, Conservatives at 31%. Is there a chance for Labour to come on? I mean, we're looking obviously at Keir Starmer at this point heading that party. But is he, as he says, perhaps somebody that could act in the public interest should he resign, in reference to Johnson?
I think in truth and in honesty, what we'll have is we have a two-party system, the same as they do in America and most of Western Europe. So what happens is when the incumbent government or the prime minister becomes a failure or is shown through his actions to be incompetent or uncaring, what we have is the pendulum that swings once upon a time from the conservative right wing to the Labour left wing. And then with Tony Blair, obviously he brought New Labour to central politics, and I would say that Starmer is a devotee of Tony Blair's politics. It's funny that Margaret Thatcher's kind of best outcome was the election of Tony Blair. So I think what we have now, if you're looking at Starmer as someone who is a real challenge to Boris Johnson, I don't think he is. I think he's a complete lightweight. I think with the destruction and the destroying of the reputation of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a lot of people who are traditional Labour voters who will not vote sure. Labour under Keir Starmer. And I think what we have is we have a Tory-lite prospective Prime Minister in waiting.
Let me jump in here quickly because we're fresh out of time and ask John White the last question. John White, you said how even the two parties here are not suffice to deal with what the UK has to deal with. And one of the issues that are at the top of the agenda for any country now is how to deal with COVID, how to make sure economic progress is going to be made, amongst all the other issues that are involved when it comes to the UK. So what are we looking at in terms of the UK's future here? How it's going to grow out of COVID when you have these scandals bringing down the current government, as it appears?
Well, COVID, in the one sense, has been a political distraction from the problems surrounding Brexit, because all of the new regulations that are going to come into force regarding Brexit come into force by the summer. So we're going to see real chaos at the ports. There's still the issue of Ireland and the border down the Irish Sea, and we've seen a push towards Irish unity, such as we haven't seen since partition in the early 1920s. We're seeing a huge upswing in support for Scottish independence. And all the while in England, they seem to be turning more and more insular in terms of their politics, in terms of the culture wars that have been unleashed there by Brexit. It's unleashed, to my mind, the forces of racism. Britain is no longer a major power, but it's trying to masquerade as one, and it's always been able to do so under the umbrella of US hegemony. Uh-huh. But since coming out of the EU, the UK is not seen as an important ally to the US as it was hitherto. And so we yet to see how this will play out in global terms. Johnson is an embarrassment. There are multiple crises that face Britain right now, including foreign policy, including economics, including the fallout from COVID, including trade, etc., etc. So this is a distraction, and I think at some point, Tory MPs, backbenchers, will have to look at their own position with regards to their constituents.
Okay.
The election comes in 2024. On this trajectory, the Tories will lose their 80-seat majority. We'll see Keir Starmer as the new Prime Minister.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. John White there. Thank you for your contribution. Writer and political analyst from Edinburgh, and Fra Hughes, journalist and political commentator from Belfast. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From the Covert Tower, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. They will be told, Do not cry this day for one destruction, but cry for much destruction.
Brothers and sisters, as you have been with us, in the previous verses, we discussed how the situation of these pagans will be in the hereafter. The Holy Quran said, إِذَا أُلْقُوا مِنْهَا مَكَانًا ضَيِّقًا مُقَرَّنِينَ دَعَوْ هُنَالِكَ ثُبُورًا When they are cast in fetters and in a narrow place of blazing fire of hell, they will call out for destruction. But now the 14th verse says, لَا تَدْعُوا الْيَوْمَ ثُبُورًا وَاحِدًا وَدْعُوا ثُبُورًا كَثِيرًا So this verse means it will be said to them, لَا تَدْعُوا الْيَوْمَ ثُبُورًا وَاحِدًا Call not this day for one destruction, وَدْعُوا ثُبُورًا كَثِيرًا But call for many destructions. This verse implies that they must not say, Woe to me, just one time, but they must say it many times. The verse says, لَا تَدْعُوا الْيَوْمَ ثُبُورًا وَاحِدًا Call not this day for one destruction, وَدْعُوا ثُبُورًا كَثِيرًا but call for many destructions. So their cry, their moaning does not have any result. There will be no death or destruction for the hellfire, but they must remain alive and experience the painful chastisements. Not the fire nor themselves will be destroyed that day. This verse is exactly like the 16th verse of chapter 2, where it says, إِصْلَوْهَا فَاصْبِرُوا أَوْ لَا تَصْبِرُوا سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْكُمْ إِنَّمَا تُجْزَوْنَ مَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ. Endure the heat thereof, and whether you are patient of it or impatient of it is all one for you. You are only being paid for what you used to do in the world. إِنَّمَا تُجْزَوْنَ مَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Anyway, this verse says that it will be said to them, call not this day for one destruction. لا تدعوا اليوم ثبورا واحدا. That who tells such words to the pagans? The context shows that the angels of chastisement will do this, because they are the ones who deal with the pagans. But the question is, why they are told that they must not say woe to me for one time, but they must say it many times? It might be because of the fact that their painful chastisement is not temporal, that it ends with saying this phrase one time. They must always repeat it during this period, and this is another chastisement apart from being burnt in the fire. Moreover, the divine punishment that is for these criminals is so miscellaneous that they face their death by experiencing each of these punishments. They call thubura for each of these kinds of chastisements. It seems that they die and become alive successively, repeating thubura and woe to me. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam in a tradition says, the people of the hell are under pressure like nail in the wall. So as we had a look at this tradition in the previous verse also, looking closer, the reason of these pagans being in such a pressure might be due to their ignorance to Allah. And this is what leads to desperate straits in this world and the other world. In fact, these are all the consequences of their disbelief in the hour of resurrection. بَلْ كَذَّبُوا بِالسَّاعَةِ وَأَعْتَدْنَا لِمَنْ كَذَّبَ بِالسَّاعَةِ سَعِيرًا. They denied the hour of resurrection, it said in the 11th verse, and we have prepared a blazing fire for him who denies the hour. These are all still the continuing consequences of that denial. They will hear its roaring and raging sound. They will be put in hellfire, coupled in fetters, in that narrow place, and there nothing will be destroyed, nor the fire, nor the pagans themselves, in order to move away from the chastisement of the Almighty Allah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Friday, EU Foreign Affairs and Defence Ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue.
That always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace. All of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We are human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for a meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP BJP in 2014, the community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue. Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence. Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively since last few years. Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018, after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions. Vaccine hesitancy and skepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. you can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated Black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that